Hello, and welcome to the Epic Echo Media Musings. In this podcast, we'll look at the movies and TV shows you know and love, and the things in them that we don't love so much. We'll shed our insight on the problematic pieces of the media we consume while giving you tips to use those pieces to start great conversations. The point of our podcast isn't that you stop watching your favorite shows and movies, but instead to help you use them to start empowering conversations with the folks you watch them with. Enjoy. Hello, Epic Echo listeners. Today's episode contains language that could be difficult or triggering for some listeners to hear pertaining to violence. If you need help or support, please call our helpline at 304-263-8292. Today's episode of Media Musings is all about the Twilight film franchise. The first film in the Twilight franchise was released on November 21st, 2008. The film was directed by Catherine Hardwicke and based on the book series by the same name, written by Stephenie Meyer. The movie grossed over $407 million worldwide, with almost $70 million coming in opening weekend in the US and Canada alone. The series is centered around Bella Swan, played by Kristen Stewart, who moves to a small town in the Pacific Northwest and falls in love with Edward Cullen, played by Robert Pattinson, a mysterious classmate who reveals himself to be a 108-year-old vampire. The series genre is classified as romance, horror, fantasy, and drama. Despite the film receiving mixed reviews from critics, the film remains popular with fans and reaches the top streamed list nearly every time it is added to a new streaming platform, taking up the top five streamed movies on Netflix in June earlier this year, nearly 13 years after the release of the first movie. As previously mentioned, the film series is based on the book series by the same name, and that series also topped charts. The book series has sold over 100 million copies worldwide and has reached the top of the bestsellers list several times with the release of each new installment of the series. Stephenie Meyer continues to release new books. However, it is unclear if these will be adapted into films as well. Today's episode, we're mostly going to be focused on the first film in the franchise that gives it its name, the Twilight franchise. And I have Nicole Rome with me today from Epic. So I'm going to ask Nicole first to give your first impression. The first time you saw the movie, what did you take away from it?
Well, first off, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be on this little baby podcast of the Epic Echo. My first impressions of the movie, honestly, so I was a pretty hardcore Twilight fan when I was a teen, when these movies were coming out, when the books were coming out. I loved the books. I was at the midnight premiere of every single movie, pre-ordered all of them, the works. This movie in particular, I didn't love just the acting and the screenplay and the adaptation was just not very good.
It's but
like,
rough.
It's one of those ones where like you love to hate it. So that was kind of like my impression. And I think that when I was reading the books and watching the movies, I knew that there were some problematic things, but I'm just a hardcore like vampire lore person, like Buffy, Vampire Diaries, all of those very, very problematic, like predatory type relationships. Like I just can't get enough of them. So now like being where I am now and doing the work that we do, a lot of these things are definitely more apparent. But yeah, first impressions, I couldn't get enough of this series.
I am right with you there. I was a little bit young for the midnight premiere of the first one. However, as I got older, I would attend some of these midnight premieres for this franchise. I was 9 when the first film was released, which really dates me, but I still was enamored by it. I was completely sucked in. Yes. To the romance, to the entire storyline. I got the books, I think for like my 10th birthday and just devoured them. Yes. Read every single one. The movies, they fell a little flat, as we all can recognize. Yes. However, I've seen them dozens upon dozens of times. Even still now in my 20s, I do rewatch at least once a year. So I just want to preface this whole biased interview on that. So obviously we're here to talk about the relationship depicted in the movie, which you've already kind of said. It is a predatory relationship, as most of these vampire fantasy shows and movies tend to be. So the main thing that I want to start out talking about is obviously these movies and books were aimed at teenagers. That's something that's very important that we need to keep in mind as we're going over this whole thing. Whereas on the last episode, we talked about 50 Shades, which is targeted more at an adult audience. This is a YA novel. It's meant for young adults, which is largely a teenage demographic. And one of the things that I think is the most dangerous about it is that it is aimed towards teenagers, and it's this romance story where it almost is trying to convince us that romance should feel dangerous, that there should be some element of danger in romance, and that danger is just romantic.
Yep.
So I was wondering if you'd like to add anything to that, any thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. So the thing that I kind of noticed from the jump, because I was watching this on like with different lenses than I typically would, as the stakes are incredibly high from the beginning, like right from the jump, she literally starts her entire like narration by saying like, to die in the place of someone I love would be like the best way to go, right? Like that, she's 17. That is not what a relationship at 17 should be like. It is very dramatic. And just, yeah, like I said, the stakes are just so steep, and it's not realistic, and it's not what relationships should feel like. You should never, ever at 17 or any age for that matter, be thinking about like how you would like to die in the place of the person that you're with. So just to start off there. And just in addition to that, like you said, with it really romanticizes like the dangerousness of the relationship, right? So there are so many times, multiple times throughout the film, particularly at the beginning, he tells her that they shouldn't be friends. So he like starts off almost every conversation with her saying, you need to stay away from me. You should stay away from me. I'm dangerous. But while simultaneously like continuing to approach her. So she's like in this weird spot, like at where she's like, okay, like this seems like it's a dangerous thing, but he's continuing to approach me. So this is romantic. And like you said, that's just a very, very dangerous message to be sending to teenagers. And as speaking as one of those teenagers, I loved this.
Right. And not only does he keep coming back to her and, you know, keep presenting her with this, I'm dangerous, you should stay away from me. There's also the pressure of all of these other students and his family being this like, oh, nobody gets in with this clique. Like nobody is able to penetrate the wall of that family. Like don't even bother. And then he obviously has this interest in her, and she is a new student who doesn't really know any of these kids. And it's very, very heightened from the instant that we see it. It's very much perceived as a life or death relationship, literally, from the moment that we see these two people meet. So that is like right off the bat, the first thing that you should notice in this whole franchise is that the romance is depicted as being dangerous. And that's not normal. That's not a great thing for us to be teaching to our teenage readers and movie watchers. The next thing that I would love to get into is the stalking aspect of this relationship, which now I feel like this movie and the book franchise came out so long ago that now we would have a different perspective on it as a culture.
Yeah.
We would see this a little bit differently through a 2021 lens than we were seeing it back in 2008. However, we're still watching it. As I said, I thought it was important to note that this topped the top five most streamed movies on Netflix just in June. That was just a couple of months ago. But there's this very present stalking happening in this relationship before it even becomes a relationship. We know that Edward is following her to go homecoming dress shopping with her friends. And of course, he ends up saving her life. But why was he there in the first place? Because he's stalking her. He's watching her sleep in her room as a teenager. Would you like to touch on the stalking?
Yes. I think you're right. I think that movies and mixed media, all the things that are coming out now are definitely more informed about these things. And had this franchise been booted up in 2021, it probably would look a little bit different. I would hope so anyway. But he literally, like, let's call it what it is. He stalks her from the moment he meets her. I think that like with the new book coming out, The Midnight Sun, it's Twilight, but from his perspective, you get a little bit more of that. I haven't actually read all of it, so I can't speak too much to it, but I have read like a couple chapters of it, and it legitimately, like from his perspective, he just spends his entire time that he's not like on screen with her stalking her. And it's also dangerous because he presents it in a way to her that it's for her own good. He stalks her because he needs to protect her, because he feels responsible for her. And again, it's very heavily romanticized. And I know that we need to keep this in the context of like, it is a fantasy story, right? Like, so there are all of these factors, but the real life implications are very real. And to say like, I need you to always tell me where you are because I need to protect you. I need to know where you are at all times. Like, these are actual manipulative tactics that are present in dating violence and domestic violence relationships that we see all the time. Like, this is not, that's not normal. You should not have to worry about your significant other going through your phone. And that is kind of something that's missing in this because it was made so long ago, but I bet you if Bella had a phone, he would have it tapped. He would be Absolutely. Looking through it. Like, he would be seeing who she's texting. So it's definitely, dangerous. And you touched on the sleeping thing too, like so bizarre, so inappropriate. And I love that you mentioned that it's before any type of commitment has even happened. He's like infatuated with this girl as soon as he meets her and is immediately going to her house and breaking and entering, like he is going into her home, and watching her sleep. And he tells her this later, I've been doing this for months, and she's loves it.
Yeah. I think the thing that I did in my rewatch that was specifically for this episode was I tried to take the fantasy aspects out of it as much as I could and just perceive the relationship as if there weren't these supernatural forces mm-hmm. involved. Mm-hmm. So I was really trying to just pinpoint like, oh, what scenario could this happen if he was not a vampire? And it was way easier, can mm-hmm. I just say, than yes. I thought it was going to be. because every moment that there is some reason that he needs to keep her safe from this lurking threat of other vampires, I mean, that's just the power and control struggle that we talk about yes. in unhealthy and in toxic relationships. There's always some threat that they can perceive that you need protected from mm-hmm. as the victim. And so any situation in this movie, whether it be, you know, the sleeping, the watching, the following her into town, you know, there's this perceived threat of violence from other vampires, but in a normal non-fantasy relationship, mm-hmm. you can also find perceived threats in everyday situations mm-hmm. that can be used with those power and control techniques that create these really unhealthy and toxic relationships. So I just think that that's really important as we're watching movies like this. We definitely need to be perceiving the relationship as what it would be for a teenager who was not dating a vampire, yes. but who was instead just dating an abusive partner.
Yes, absolutely.
One specific example that I would love to just spend a couple of minutes on here is the scene where they have gone to the Collins house, and it's the first time she's meeting the family, and they're in Edward's bedroom, and they're talking about dancing, I think, or something. And she says, I'm not scared of you. And he says, you shouldn't have said that. And then throws her on her back and jumps out the window and runs through the trees.
Yes. Yes.
Well, this specific example really, really sticks out to me because all he's doing in this moment is something that he knows will scare her and will put her in danger, because then he's going to seem like this protective yes. person that he wants to be. Compare that to just you being in the passenger seat of a car with someone who's abusive and saying, I'm the only person that can protect you. See, watch. And then they go from 0 to 100 mm-hmm. on the highway mm-hmm. and you're also unsafe, but they stop the car and you're safe mm-hmm. perceivably because of them,
yes.
even though they put you in danger.
Yes.
So I didn't know if you would want to touch on that at all, but that one really, really gets me, because this perceived danger is a whole other aspect in this fantasy relationship. But this scene, you don't even have to take the fantasy out of it. He puts mm-hmm. her in danger specifically just so that he can be the one to make her feel safe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think, yes, absolutely. And I think something similar happens in the scene where she walks into the woods and he follows her into the woods. Mm-hmm. In both situations, he literally drags her through the woods and takes her to a place that she would never conceivably be able to find her way out of. Like, she doesn't know where she is. And in the scene you're referring to, she's literally in the trees. So like, that's a whole other like bizarre thing. But yeah, it is. It's like that pattern of control where you are the one that puts me in danger, but you're also the one that gets me out of it. You're also the one that protects me. And we do talk about this cycle a lot with our clients. Like it's that trauma bond is so hard to break because they're the ones that, you know, the abuse occurs with, but they are also the ones that are there to nurture you once things have come down. So like, there's definitely that dynamic to it, but I definitely had the same thought. Like he literally like takes her into the woods and I can't, in that the beginning of that scene, right before he drags her out that window and starts crawling around the trees, he says to her that like, he wants to dance or something. Mm-hmm. And she says, I'm not really a good dancer. And he says, I could make you. Mm-hmm. And in the scene in the woods that I was referring to, he takes her there and literally shows her all of the ways that he could kill her, which I had not really thought about before, like until I watched it again through this lens. He takes her there and says, you can't outrun me, and shows her how fast he is. He says, you would never be able to fight me off because look how strong I am, throws like a whole tree across the woods. And then proceeds to say like, and you would never be able to deny me because look how beautiful I am. Like, so he's presenting it in a way that like, I'm being honest with you about all of my flaws so that you can make an informed decision. But he's also telling her, I have complete control over you and I could kill you at any moment. And that's scary.
Absolutely. And I think she's also supposed to maybe take some kind of comfort in that somehow. That's kind of the way that her whole mentality is perceived, is that it's like almost comforting to her that he could absolutely kill her at any moment, but he hasn't. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that she's really holding on to. But I think that these examples really stand out to me in such a unique way, because we don't really get examples of this specific type of domestic violence in any other situation. And we don't even really have to remove the fantasy from these situations. Mm-hmm. Because although, yes, they're flying through the trees or, you know, doing these things, what happens is they come to a standstill in one spot and he shows her how dangerous the situation would be if he wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And we don't really see that too often in movies that don't have this fantasy aspect, even though, I mean, this is as clear cut of a depiction, yes, of that type of relationship as we could get. So I think that that is something that we all need to be aware of that is happening in this film. That's a really great conversation starter. Obviously, we're talking a lot about the relationship aspect here. I do want to also talk on the oppressive aspect, mm-hmm, just a little bit, because there is always something interesting to be said about our favorite movies when it comes to oppression. And this one is, again, a pretty clear-cut example. The vampires in this film are seen as perfect. That's how they're described, as undeniably perfect from every feature, every article of clothing. It all falls perfectly. It's exactly perfect. And they're perfectly white. Yes. Every vampire
they're
that we
literally
get,
called pale faces,
mm-hmm, are perfectly white. However, we do have one vampire of color, I guess you would call it, and he's a villain. Mm-hmm. Because of course he is. Even though our main cast members here are literally villains, the only perceived villains that we see are this trio of outsider vampires, and one of them, of course, happens to be the only real Black character we get in the entire film.
Yep.
So I think that that's also important to note. Although, yes, we can say that these movies came out years ago, I truly don't think today that that would have changed much, because we haven't seen much change, mm-hmm, in that area.
Yep.
I didn't know if you'd want to add anything to that. Obviously, we see this a lot. Mm-hmm. We saw this in the last movie that we did, and I'm sure we'll see it in just about everyone that we see to follow.
Absolutely. It's actually kind of bizarre. I had listened to the last podcast to kind of prep for this one. So I, again, was, you know, had a different lens on while I was watching this film and was so expecting to just get lost in like a domestic violence and stalking hole. And the amount of racism and just like implicit and explicit in this film actually overtook the entire other conversation for me. Because you're absolutely right. There are two characters of color in this film. One of them is Tyler.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Fun note about Tyler, though, who has a name in the books, is never named in the film.
Oh, of course.
He literally is never named in the film, despite the fact that he has a very real name that was given to him in the books. The first time you see him, he kisses Bella on the cheek, mm-hmm. against her will. She doesn't ask for that. And the second time you see him, he almost kills her with his van. And again, completely just goes without a name the entire film, which is bizarre. And then I had this same note with Laurent, the vampire of color in the film, who's like very overly sexualized too, which I noticed, which I kind of wanted to loop in to talk about the franchise as a whole. Like in the second film, there's obviously a huge conversation about like Indigenous folks to be had here.
Absolutely.
Very sexualized as well. There's like not a whole lot of variety in their fashion. Like there is the same way with the Cullens, but like you said, the only vampire of color in this film is perceived as a villain, and he's not a vegetarian like the Cullens right. are. He eats people because he's, you know, he's the bad one, and the Cullens are the good guys because they don't eat people. So yeah, I definitely took that same perspective away.
And I wanted to get into the Quileates next, because I do want to preface this by saying that I completely understand that this is all fictional. In this representation in this movie, the author of the books did not do proper research. There's horrible, horrible, horrible inaccuracies about Native culture and about Native people. And it's really, really, really tough to watch again and again and again, and to know that this is, for a lot of folks, probably the only representation of, you know, like a modern Native community that we see. Mm-hmm. And it's so wrong. And it's so starkly contrasting from the white vampires yes. that we see in the film, who live in this beautiful window cabin in the middle of these glorious woods. Yes. And then somehow within the same town, the reserve, which I don't believe we see this until the next movie, but I mean, they live on unpaved roads and dirt paths, and the screen door is always open, mm-hmm. and they are shirtless and barefoot, and obviously they're werewolves, so you could attribute some of that to them being werewolves, but I don't think that that's all there is there mm-hmm. to unpack. I think that was the easy write-off that was used by the author personally, was, well, I don't have to research the culture of these people because they're not people, they're werewolves. Mm-hmm. But I think that that was just a cop out. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was incredibly disrespectful. So I wanted to touch on that mm-hmm. as well.
I think that I absolutely agree, first of all, but I think that the tribe actually also felt it was a cop out. I did a little bit of research on this, and there's like entire websites and like a museum in Washington where they actually go out of their way to discuss the misconceptions of this tribe in Twilight. Because you're right, Stephenie Meyer did not do her research. She did not consult with these people at all at any point about the traditions that she's writing about, or even down to like the tattoo design in the second film apparently was just like melding from all different kinds of like different like Indigenous folks and tribes that they could find. They just like melded them all together, like out without actually, like I said, consulting these people. So it's pretty unfortunate too that she profited so much off of this, and these folks have never seen any of that money. In the second film, they even did film like on the reservation, like on, and they still, like there was no, you know, money to be had for these people. It's a very small tribe. And it's pretty sad actually. And you're right. Like in contrast with the Cullens, who Bella even describes herself as being in their most basic form in the sun, glittery and beautiful. She like the Indigenous people are literally dogs. They're yep. literally described as mongrels who are aggressive in their most basic form and can't control themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even if we looked into the further films, which we won't do too much today, the self-control, somehow we have these two monsters that are at the head of this love triangle, but yet we still see that the white monster is definitely able to exercise more self-control. Although I would argue that that doesn't really make a lot of sense. I would think that a vampire would not be able to exercise as much self-control around a community full of humans. Mm-hmm. And then the wolves have trouble just keeping this treaty. Like, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. It's blatantly disguised racism. So I definitely wanted to make sure that we could touch on that a little bit as well. And I think that we have. So this next little piece of the show, I really just want to talk about those conversations that we want you guys to be having again. So as we talked about in the last episode, the whole point of this show is not to cancel Twilight. As you've just heard, we are two huge Twilight fans here giving you this podcast. We're not trying to get you not to watch it. We're actually trying to get you to watch it more with the people that you care about and to have these really great conversations. So before I give my two cents, I wonder if you would be willing to just give your words of advice for people. What conversations should they be having while they're watching this movie? What should their takeaways be after today?
Absolutely. I think that it's important to, first and foremost, just recognize that it is a fantasy-based like piece of fiction, right? It is not meant to, definitely, it's not meant to be like your poster child for a perfect relationship. And in a lot of ways, that is a little bit sad because we do have all of these like very problematic things happening. And by the end of the franchise, like there's this happy ending. So you can't always like just assume because like all of these things are occurring, like it's going to be okay, because in the end, you're going to end up on top and you're going to end up with your true love. So just like remembering that this is a work of fiction and you're allowed to love the things you love, whether it's a guilty pleasure or not. I have all of these films, I've watched all of these films, I've read all of the books. So just bearing in mind that it is a work of fiction, but also like not being afraid to say these things to the folks you're watching the movie with. I actually watched this movie with my boyfriend who did not want to watch it at all. But I presented it to him as, well, why don't you watch this with me and we can like take turns picking out all the problematic things. And he loved that. So he was not like spot on writing down all the same things that I was. So I would encourage you to do that, not only with people who are like-minded, but also the folks that maybe aren't, and just using it as a conversation piece. I am doing this a lot more now than I ever have, because I really, really love movies. I love media. I love books. There are a lot of classic films that I have just adored in the past that I can't really bring myself to watch now. So there are certain things that like I kind of have pushed out of my wheelhouse as far as watching, but this is not one of those things. And I think that it is just important to just use it for an opportunity to start a conversation.
Yeah, I think you brought up a really, really great point that I want to make sure that I touch on, which is that everyone has their boundaries as far as like what is too far for a movie to go out of your comfort zone to not watch it. I think that that's perfectly fine. If you feel that any of these movies contain pieces that would be, you know, extremely triggering or extremely upsetting to you, obviously we're not asking that you watch these movies again to see if you're going to have some different take. We're not trying to convince anyone to watch or not to watch. We're just trying to let the people know that are watching that you can use it to start these great conversations. And I think those were all great points. I am going to go a slightly different route with my answer. I am going to target mine specifically towards any adults or parents who have teenagers. I have a lot of teenage siblings right now running around in the world. And I know that this is something that I hope to do with them, because they made fun of me as kids when I was a teenager watching Twilight, but now I'm ready to flip the tables and kind of get my revenge. And I just really think that the most important takeaway that I would tell any parent or adult who loves a teenager is to watch this movie with the teenagers that you love, and just make sure you're having conversations about that aspect of romance being dangerous. We need to get that completely so far out of our culture that it's not even funny. I remember being a teenager and hearing, you know, my friends talk about their relationships and how, well, obviously, you know, if we're fighting this much, there's got to be something here worth fighting for, or mm-hmm. something like that. And just this perception that like love as a teenager has to be high stakes. Mm-hmm. I'm in my early 20s, not too far off from a teenager. And I can say that none of my relationships have ever felt high stakes. And that's because they were, for the most part, healthy. But I know that that's something that a lot of teenagers struggle with when we're consuming all of this media and all of these predatory relationships and these protectors that mm-hmm. are in these relationships that are actually toxic. I just think that we need to start having way more conversations about the fact that love can be soft and gentle, and that it's not high stakes, that you can just love someone in a very lighthearted and fun way, and that it doesn't have to be this push and pull of good versus evil or mm-hmm. any. Obviously, this movie is a fantasy. That's something you should add into these conversations too. But I think that the implementations of like what happens in this relationship are very, very real. So I would just say, please sit down with those teenagers that you love, have a talk with them about your relationship. And, you know, they might see your relationship as someone who is older, whose relationship has mellowed out and fizzled off. But no, you need to be having those conversations and telling them that that is just what a real relationship looks like, so that we're not fostering so much of this toxicity in relationships by thinking that there's a protector out there for everyone and mm-hmm. you just have to find them and you're going to find them in a dangerous situation, because it's just not true. Mm-hmm.
And that like drama has to be present, or a certain amount of just that dramatic like situation needs to be present. That's not okay. It's not healthy, and it won't feel good.
And it's not going to end this way either. It's not going to end in a big wedding and a baby. And even if we were doing the whole series, we would have to touch on how even when they do get married, it comes with the price of Bella has to give up everybody that she's ever known and her entire family so that she can become this vampire. And that has some very real life messaging behind it as well. There's a lot to unpack here. I definitely think this is a great gateway into having conversations with the young adults and the teenagers in your life. Anything else to add before we close up?
Not really. Just in terms of like, just going off that same vein of like having these conversations with your teens. Obviously in the film, Edward is 17, and I put quotation marks, obviously this is not the right media for, you can't see me doing that, but he's 17, but he's much older than that. And I do see a trend, like with all of the advocates and all of the offices here at Epic, where there are teenagers who are being approached by older men, sometimes even women, in a very predatory fashion. And a lot like this adult person is putting the ball in their court and saying like, you should stay away from me, but this is kind of what I have to offer, and I'm going to keep approaching you. And the ball's really in your court. And it's not, it's just not. You parents, you need to be talking to your kids about how that's not okay. That's not healthy. And it is 100% in this film, in the whole franchise, the ball is in Edward's court to break this off. He is the 100-year-old man. And in terms of the real life situations that we see here at Epic, like these people are the adults, and they're putting oftentimes a lot of pressure on kids to make the decisions about these adult relationships that are not actually adult relationships.
Yeah, an excellent point. And although, yes, obviously Edward is supposed to be 17, you can still apply that in the exact same way. Edward has been through high school 100 times already now. He knows what teenage girls think like. Mm-hmm. He's seen decades of high school girls go through relationships, and he's been right there for it all. So he's kind of had plenty of time to take notes and learn how to manipulate. And I think mm-hmm. that he ended up doing just that. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much for sitting down with me today. I think this was a really good conversation. Obviously, we hope that you take all of this to heart with you, and that you all have these conversations at your next Twilight viewing party.
It is, the whole franchise is now on Netflix. So it did recently come to Netflix. So if you're interested in rewatching with your friends or your kids, with a new, you know, perspective and vantage point, enjoy. Let us know what you think.
Yeah, as soon as you end this episode, you can schedule your viewing party, and then you can let us know how it goes. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. Nicole, thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Media Musings. Do you have an idea for a TV show or a movie that we should talk about next? Send your ideas over to us at epicwv.org/epic-echo. Thanks for listening.